This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In 1942, America was at war, and the Allies were playing catch-up in their fight against the Axis powers, headed by Hitler and Mussolini in Europe and Hirohito in Japan. Young American men went to war while huge sacrifices were being made at home to ensure victory. Women left home in droves to replace men in the factories that were making armaments and other materials for the war effort. Rosie the Riveter became the iconic stand-in for every woman doing their part to help the Allies win. Most of those women knew what they were working on, but a special few did not. Among them, the women who went to work in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Just after Christmas, 1942, President Roosevelt authorized a top-secret project that would ultimately end the war and usher in a new era. The work was to be done on 59,000 acres of land along the Clinch River just west of Knoxville. The location was first known as Site X, later changed to Clinton Engineer Works. Upwards of 45,000 people would come to work there, and yet it was a secret city. It appeared on no maps. Many of the people working there didn't know precisely what they were working on. Among those workers were a half dozen young women who would only later discover they were part of the Manhattan Project to build the first atomic bomb, the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Their story, unlike those of other women contributing to the World War II effort, has been little known. But now Denise Kiernan has written about it in her fascinating book and a New York Times bestseller, The Girls of Atomic City, The Untold Story of the Women Who Helped Win World War II. Denise Kiernan, if you recall, has been on this program in the past to talk about several smaller tomes that she collaborated on with her husband. They were about the founders of our country and some of the founding documents of our country. She lives here in North Carolina and joins us once again. It's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. In a way, I don't feel like a book is really out until I come on your show and talk to you.
Oh, don't give me that. You did Jon Stewart first.
Okay, I did do The Daily Show first. I'm sorry. You'll forgive me, I hope.
Was that fun? I heard that it was wonderful that you made him laugh and that you were very funny on the show, which is not the object, I don't think, for the guest to be funny.
Exactly. And when you're sitting across from someone like Jon Stewart, the last thing you should do is try and out-funny him. But it was wonderful because he was clearly very excited about the book and the topic. And, you know, I've watched him so many times. Yeah. It was a real treat.
Does he looks like he reads all the books, and he does a book a night. Does he read these books, do you think?
I don't, you know, I can only speak about my experience. I have no doubt in my mind he read my book cover to cover. I mean, not like skimming.
He must be a speed reader.
I don't know how he does it. I don't know how he does it. And I love, you know, as an author, I really appreciate what his show does for books.
Sure, absolutely. Because you would think, I mean, it's one of the few outlets in media in the country where books get covered. Maybe the Diane Rehm Show.
But especially, you know, on that, the level of penetration into mm-hmm. the market that show has is unbelievable, not just when it airs, but online as well. I was hearing from people I hadn't seen or heard from in years after that show aired. Just, did I see you on The Daily Show last night? Somebody's mother who's like in her 70s, I was like, you're watching The Daily Show? You know, he really, really reaches a lot of people.
How does that work? How did you get picked to be on The Daily Show? Do they call you? Do your people, your publisher call him and say, we got this book? And
well, publicists across, you know, from every publishing house, they pretty much send almost every book that their house is publishing to The Daily Show because everybody right. wants to get on there because it has such a tremendous audience. And he has a producer who sort of goes through the giant pile of books first and then, you know, to kind of winnow it down. And then she goes through those books with him, you know, ones that she thinks will appeal to him, and he makes the final choice.
Had you been on before? Because the other two books that you were on here to talk about, Signing Their Lives Away and Signing Their Rights Away, seem to be right up his alley.
They do. No, I haven't been on before. I would have thought that maybe he'll have me back on
I'll
to talk
him.
About those two. Give him a ring.
Because we all know each other.
Give him a ring, yes. It's a very small world.
It's a very small world. I didn't get tickets when he was here. I couldn't get in. you talked to a lot of these women who worked on the Manhattan Project mm-hmm. at Site X in Tennessee. All of these women, obviously members of what Tom Brokaw has called the greatest generation, and a lot of what you say about them fit his description of how he described the greatest generation. You describe them as humble, patient, imbued in their youth by a sense of adventure and independence, and today with a dedication to the preservation of history.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find these women? Because they've got to be up in years now.
The youngest ones are, I think, my youngest girl. They still call each other girls. It's adorable.
Really?
Yes. That's
and is that where
fantastic.
The title of the girls of Atomic City comes from? Because they call themselves
that's
girls?
That's part of it. Whenever they'd refer to each other, oh, you should meet one of the other girls who worked with me at the plant. And so it was that was one inspiration for the title. And another was I really wanted to convey the youth of these young women when they got there. I mean, many of them just got out of high school, leaving their parents' home for the first time, never been out of their towns. That's a girl in many ways. And you know, then the subtitle refers to them as women because I really do think that they grew a lot in their time in Oak Ridge. But going back to your question, the way I found them was I contacted someone who had written a newsletter article about them, and I asked him, I said, can you point me, Ray Smith, he's one of the, does some history work in Oak Ridge, can you point me in the direction of one of these ladies? And one of the first women I met was Colleen, who's in my book.
Mm-hmm. Colleen
and
Rowan.
Colleen Rowan was, she starts out as a Rowan, finishes the book as a Black.
Mm-hmm. She was a leak pipe inspector.
She inspected pipes. That's right. Every day in and day out, she inspected pipe welds because they had to make sure that the pipes in one particular plant, K-25, were all sealed as tightly as possible.
And where had she come from? What was her background prior to taking that job? What was she?
She came with close to, if you included her extended family, about between 11 and 15 people, depending on whether or not you count all the aunts and uncles, from Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay.
And she had a brother, you know, fighting overseas, which was the case for the majority of the people I talked to. Everyone was touched by the war. I mean, everyone knew someone who was away fighting, and that was certainly a factor for a lot of these women for wanting to actually, you know, do something for the war effort. But yeah, Colleen came over with a good chunk of her family from Nashville and went to work checking pipes.
And like a lot of the women who worked in factories and who for whom Rosie the Riveter became the iconic symbol for all of them, most of these women were not employed there as in secretarial positions. She was a leak pipe inspector. Dorothy Jones was, I don't even know what this is, a Calutron operator.
A Calutron cubicle operator, sure.
Rosemary, is it Myers? Mayers, M-A-I-E-R-S, was a nurse. Jane Greer was a statistician and mathematician. Were they hiring these women for non-clerical positions?
In addition to clerical positions.
But because the men weren't available, because the men were fighting, is that why they were hiring them?
That's certainly a big part of what was going on. They needed a tremendous workforce. And, of course, this was something that was going on across the country and in other parts of the world. There were so many men away fighting that for women it was a new phase in their work lives. I mean, they were getting opportunities they would have never had
right.
before. So, yes, they were still working as secretaries, but they were also, you know, working in giant factories climbing around on pipes.
The world was so different then. We were not
really
connected.
Is.
We lived in our little universe, which was our small hometown, and except for radio and maybe the headlines that came in on the weekly or the daily.
You watched the
paper.
Radio.
Exactly right. You weren't part of something. There were no big chain, big box stores that connected America. There were no McDonald's in every town. Everything was different everywhere. And for the fact that a person like Dorothy Jones to be hired right out of high school,
mm-hmm.
And there was another
from Hornbeek, Tennessee.
Okay, and another woman that you write about, I think, who comes from Shenandoah, Pennsylvania, which we'll talk about later. For these kids to walk away from everything they knew, for their parents to let them go, and not even know where they were going or what they were going to be doing when they got there, to me, is absolutely astounding.
You're hitting on one of the aspects of this story that continues to fascinate and kind of inspire me. I mean, I'm watching friends now send their 18-year-old daughters off to college, and these are kids who know how to drive and have already had part-time jobs and have phones and their own little bank account. And then you have, you know, someone like Celia from Shenandoah, Pennsylvania, you know, or Dot right out of high school, recruited right from her high school halls, you know, getting on a bus alone. You're going to get off in Knoxville, go here, someone will tell you what you're doing. To me, that's incredibly adventurous. And when that would be adventurous today.
Yes.
Take that situation and put it in 1942, and it's just remarkable
to me. And these
were
government people telling them this, right?
It was either, in some cases, it was government recruiters, but also the government contracted into many different corporations that managed the different plants.
So I know we were more naive back then. But with that, I think comes less trust, not more. And it seems like this is a this is trust with a big T.
Oh yeah, this is a capital T trust. Absolutely.
Yeah. Why did they trust these people?
Here's these young women and the men. You know, there were men, plenty of men there as well. They may not have known what kind of job they were going to be doing. They may not have known the name of this mysterious secret town they were going to. They may not have known how long their job was going to last. But there was one thing that they knew, and that the project they were going to be working on was going to help end World War II. And that was the great cause of their lives.
Right.
And really, for pretty much everybody, it was, you know, pack my one cardboard suitcase and put on my best dress and I'm game.
Because Celia is a good case in point. She's the woman from Shenandoah, Pennsylvania. One of her brothers, I think, is fighting. One of her brothers is a priest.
Mm-hmm.
And her mother never wanted her to even have a job, much less leave town, and fought her tooth and nail every step of the way to get her first couple of jobs, which took her out of town, not terribly far. But as far away as Manhattan, where she was living in a rooming house with girls. Now, this is a different world than today. I mean, so for a girl to, as you say, pack her suitcase, put on her one and only best dress and pair of shoes, get on a train, not knowing where she was going, and being told, don't worry about it, we'll take care of you. When you get there, we'll come get you.
Mm-hmm. It's stunning. And in Celia's case, she was actually working for what we now call the Manhattan Project in Manhattan. And she didn't, of course, they didn't refer to it as that back then. And all she knew is that she was a government secretary. And she gets called into her boss's office and he says, we're moving the headquarters. Okay. Where are we going? It's down south. I can't really tell you specifically. Okay. How long are we going to be there? Maybe 6 months, maybe nine. Okay. What am I going to be doing? Probably similar to what you're doing here. Okay, well, if I don't know where I'm going, how am I going to get there? So, we're going to send a car to pick you up, and the car will take you to the train, and someone on the train will tell you when to get off, and everything will be taken care of. And off she went.
And when she got to the train, she discovered she was not alone.
She was not alone. There was a lot of recruiting going on. When they originally built Oak Ridge, they thought they were going to have about 13,000 people there. By the middle of 1945, a town that had not existed had grown from nothing, basically a mud pit in southern Appalachia, to a town operating 24 hours a day with 75,000 residents using more electricity than New York City.
Unbelievable. We have to take a break. We're going to come back and explore more of this fascinating story with Denise Kiernan, the author of The Girls of Atomic City, on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and WBTV News 3. Mornings and evenings, the WBTV First Alert traffic team provides traffic updates and alternate routes, also on mobile app and at WBTV.com.
And support for Charlotte Talks also comes from WFAE members and dermatology, laser, and vein specialists of the Carolinas, welcoming Dr. Olson and Dr. Kosari to the practice, providing state-of-the-art skincare to the Charlotte region. Details at carolinaskin.com. Coming up Monday on Charlotte Talks, arthritis is a painful condition that affects millions of Americans every day. Over 300,000 children in America suffer from juvenile arthritis. Arthritis and related conditions cost the U.S. economy over $100 billion a year and result in tens of millions of outpatient doctor visits. Exactly what is arthritis, though? What causes it? How can it be controlled? We'll talk with a few key experts about living with and managing arthritis Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. President Obama seeks support for military strikes in Syria. The White House steps up its PR campaign for healthcare enrollment and the latest unemployment numbers.
As always, you're invited to join the News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show right after Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon here on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Denise Kiernan is our guest, the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Girls of Atomic City, The Untold Story of the Women Who Helped Win World War II. I had the galley, so the galley doesn't have any pictures. That's the first question I was asked the producers. Are there pictures?
Is this a picture book? There are some wonderful pictures, and you know, actually choosing the pictures for the book was rather difficult because thanks to Ed Westcott, who was the official photographer in Oak Ridge during World War II, there was a tremendous collection of photos depicting life and work in Oak Ridge during the war, and it's just an amazing resource.
Well, I got to tell you, a picture may be worth a thousand words after all, because I was trying to picture what this place might look like as I read through it, and now I see what it looked like, and it's pretty bleak by tomorrow.
It's pretty
standards.
Muddy, yeah.
It's really muddy, and they're living either in trailers or in these prefab homes that are delivered and set up and put on stilts on the hillside, and it just looks pretty bleak.
Well, you have to imagine, in many ways, you know, some of the women would refer to it as like sort of a frontier pioneer town. I mean, here you arrived, you didn't know where you were going, you go through this gate, and there's, you know, barbed wire and guards and dogs and, you know, guns and things, and then you get through, and pretty much you see a lot of mud because this town was built so quickly, and then you got to get everything out of the way. And the minute it rains, you get those good, you know, what do they call them? Those frog stranglers, you know, over in East Tennessee, and you get all that clay mud. And it was growing so fast. At the height of construction, there was a prefab home going up one every 30 minutes. So when they couldn't keep up with housing, they would put trailers up. You know, they would put up other little prefab constructions. There were dorms initially. They kept having to construct more and more of those. So, you know, they didn't have any proper sidewalks. They had wooden planks laying over the mud. It's just, imagine just going from zero to 100 in, you know, under 3 years.
It's astounding. Now these people came from all over the place, these women, and also the men who worked there, but we're talking about the women. And they were all about, what, the same age, very young, out of high school, out of college, first couple of jobs.
Yes.
Leaving home. And the secrecy of the project, the fact that no one knew what they were working on in a town that no one knew existed, wasn't even on the map. How did the government recruit? How did people find out about these jobs if these jobs were for a project that didn't exist?
This speaks to several aspects of the project. First of all, once you were working on any of the Manhattan Project sites, okay, the vast majority of people did not know at all what they were doing. Up in the higher, you know, higher echelons, of course. Okay, so how do you find people to work on a job they don't know what they're doing? You get very, very specific. Everything about the project was extremely compartmentalized. You mentioned Colleen earlier. She inspected pipes.
Right.
So Colleen's life was, you are going to inspect pipes. Don't ask why you're inspecting pipes. You're going to inspect pipes. We're going to show you exactly how to inspect pipes. Take this weld, run it over the pipe like this. If there are any leaks, mark them, inspect the next pipe. That's it. No questions about where the pipes are coming from, where the pipes are going, what is going to be going through the pipes, none of that. So the training process was extremely focused. All you knew was just enough to do your specific job.
So
when they were, oh, I'm sorry. When,
no, go ahead.
Yeah, when they were recruiting, And this was actually a challenge for the project because they needed workers very badly, but they couldn't, you know, you would see ads from that time if you go back to old newspapers, you know, come build bombers in Tacoma, you know, and
yes.
you kind of get everybody, you know, really excited about what they're going to be doing. And the ads for the project were great construction jobs in Tennessee. And that was pretty much it. I mean, all you knew was construction. And the hiring agency was probably one of the subcontractors who was doing construction.
And that was going to be my question. I mean, how do you get – it's one thing to get people there, but when you get them there, they see where they are in mm-hmm. the middle of nowhere
sure.
in temporary housing built quickly on the sides of muddy hillsides.
Mm-hmm.
How do you – and they all wanted to contribute to the war
yes.
effort, but they didn't know what they were doing, and they didn't know what they were contributing to, and they didn't know what they were doing and how it added up. At least Rosie the Riveter saw the airplane go out of the other end of the factory. Nothing came out of here.
Well, you're
everything went in and nothing came out.
That was the cadence. Everything's coming in and nothing's going out. And for a lot of people, that was one of the most fascinating aspects because there they were – in, you know, like you said, we're talking, you know, 58,000 acres, four giant plants, everything running 24 hours a day, shifts around the clock, one of the largest bus systems in the United States, these giant machines, train cars after train car coming in and, you know, hitting the edge of the reservation of Site X, being transferred over to control of the project, emptied, and then going out empty. So everyone just sat there and watched all of this activity and all of these materials come in, and they saw nothing leave. Because in truth, what was leaving was a guy with a coffee cup-sized container in a briefcase attached to his wrist getting on a train to go out to New Mexico. That's what was leaving. But it was perplexing.
Aside from construction materials,
mm-hmm.
what was coming in?
Well, think about everything that you would need to maintain a population of 75,000 people. You know, food. You know, food. They were building schools. They had to get school books. You know, clothing. There were some stores. I mean, there were materials for the people who were actually running, you know, small businesses on the reservation.
Could they? That was going to be my other question. Could they leave?
And oh,
once,
yes.
Once they got there, because it had to be so secret and no one knew what went on in the place, could they leave?
They could. There were, and in fact, there were also, I talk about at the height of population, the height of the population of Oak Ridge in 45 being about 75,000, there were also people living in the surrounding areas who commuted in to work. So if you take them into consideration, you're talking about close to 100,000 people on that reservation every day,
yeah.
if you include the people coming in and commuting. So what you had, if you lived there, badges ran your life. You had a badge that identified you as a resident, and then you had another badge that identified where you worked. And these were very, very specific pieces of identification. For example, if you worked at the Y-12 plant, your badge would allow you to get on a bus that took you to that plant. You would be stopped, taken off, probably questioned if you tried to get on the K-25 bus with a Y-12 badge. Badges had numbers and colors indicating often which floor of a building you were allowed to go to, which bathrooms you were allowed to use. So your movements were tracked, and every time you went in or out of the gates, you were checked for your badge, your car was inspected, things of that nature. So you could come and go, but people, you know, were tracking who came and went.
What did they – could they write home? And not many people could make long-distance calls back then. It was too expensive. But could they call home? And if they did, was their correspondence monitored so that it wasn't they didn't say anything they shouldn't have said to anybody outside the facility?
Well, the message not to talk about what you were doing was, of course, throughout the United States and other parts of the world. Loose lips sink ship. Yes, there we go. So take that message and just, you know, you ratchet up the importance of it when you're working on the Manhattan Project. So there were billboards and flyers and messages everywhere telling people, do not talk about what you're doing. I know you don't know what you're doing, but still don't talk about it. don't talk about any of it. You could write home. Mm-hmm. Mail was censored. Celia's mother, the one who never wanted her to leave home, there was like one phone in the dorm. You could take turns, you know. And her mother called one day and said, just stop writing me. And Celia said, what do you mean stop writing you? She goes, it's just black streaks across all the letters that come here. I can't understand. And this, of course, makes Celia, she's racking her brain going, what did I say wrong? What did I say wrong? What did I say wrong? And that sort of just made people, you know, want to talk less about what they were doing.
And they had, I don't want to call them spies, but they had people who reported.
Informants. Yes. There was an official security force that was out and about doing what I mentioned earlier, checking badges on buses, things of that nature, making sure people were where they were supposed to be. And then there was a large force of just kind of plainclothes community informants. One of the young women I feature, Helen, she was approached, you know, just 18 years old, you know, had just arrived. She was, you know, had gotten a job out of high school working at a diner. They took her from there and she came to Oak Ridge. And one night she was approached and they said, would you mind listening in on conversations of your friends and colleagues at work and then write down what you hear on these forms we have for you and put them in these pre-addressed envelopes, and we have a secret drop box. No one will know it was you, and you know it's addressed to Acme Insurance. It sounds like something out of, you know, Wile E. Coyote or something, you know. And so the idea was you could just, you know, I heard so and so in the cafeteria at this time talking about, you know, how many different managers they had on the shift or something like that. And you put it in a little piece of paper, put it in the envelope. The envelope
goes
in the box.
What would happen if they decided that was something that shouldn't be talked about?
You'd lose your job if they thought it was, you know, if they really thought you were talking out of turn, you'd lose your job, and that was it. And if you had moved there to work, that meant you lost your housing too.
Now they built this place in the hollers of Tennessee,
mm-hmm.
a place where I would think, correct me if I'm wrong, that a lot of people went to and lived in because they wanted to be away from everybody and everything, particularly the government. And many of them, I would assume, also had lived there for generations.
Yes, many generations.
Many of them were absolutely poverty-stricken. They didn't have a pair of shoes. And the government comes in and needs all this land, 59,000 acres, and I think it was going to be even bigger than that at one point.
It went from 56 to around 58, 59, yeah.
How did the government get this land from these people who may have lived in a shack on the side of a hill because daddy and daddy before him and daddy before him and the daddy before him had always lived there? How did they get this property?
They took it they paid for it, mm-hmm. but they essentially seized it. What happened was they would go around to people that fell within the boundaries that they were interested in taking control of. And people came home one day to find letters. And they might have been, you know, tacked to a tree, stuck to the front door, you know, on top of the truck. And it said, the government needs your property for a war effort. And initially they were calling it the Kingston Demolition Range. You have, you know, in good cases, some people might have had a month or 6 weeks. Some people had about 2 weeks to get off their land. And
where did they go?
That's, you know, that depended. A lot of people went to go stay with other family in the area.
Because as I said, many of these people didn't have shoes. And if they didn't have shoes,
right.
They certainly didn't have transportation.
Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful question.
Yeah. And the money that they paid them for their property, was that enough to get something else? To buy something else, to rent something, to travel from that place to someplace else?
Well, what happened was as these people were being cleared out, this giant war factory town was being built, and they were already recruiting people to build that town, so you had a tremendous influx of people. So you had more people and less housing. So it was a very difficult situation for some folks.
And I know that there had been a tradition of the government coming in and taking land for a dam.
Especially in that area.
And that dam, the construction of that dam obviously created jobs. It was the Great Depression. People needed jobs. Mm-hmm. And so some of them saw that as an economic development thing coming in here. But others felt they weren't paid a fair price.
That's true.
And they got very upset about it.
There were community meetings. I mean, remember, some people had actually, for a very unfortunate few, the project in Oak Ridge represented the third time they had been moved off land. Mm. Once for the Smoky Mountains National Park, second time for the Norris Dam, and then the third time for this project. And there are court papers that I found at the archives about, people going back and trying to get more money. I have, from the records, you can see some of these cases were still open after the war was over. So, several years later, there were community meetings. You could, they talked to their congressmen. They try, it was hard, but I mean, the train had already left the station.
So given the fact that the government comes in and starts seizing and paying for massive amounts of land and displacing a lot of people, some of whom get very upset because they don't feel that they were paid the market rate or a good rate for their piece of property, how do they keep this secret? How did this town stay secret with all these angry people and all these people coming in? How is it possible to keep it secret?
Well, you have to remember that if you got anywhere near the gates with a camera, that wasn't going to go over well. I mean, today some, 10-year-old would Instagram a photo of, the gates and the gig would be up in, 2 seconds. But
Did the media not report it at all, the local media?
There was some media, mm-hmm. but what it was there's a very large, what everybody knew, there is a very large war project. Okay. We don't know how large it is because all we can see is this gate. I don't know how much land is behind this gate. Anybody who had their property seized.
Had airplanes back then. They could have flown over, couldn't they?
They could have, but we didn't have, The media didn't have airplanes. And there was a lot of, you have to remember, there was a lot of self-censorship going on. I mean, newspapers and magazines,
cooperated.
They cooperated. They agreed. They got memos. Do not use these words anymore.
And they followed those.
And they followed those. And nobody wanted to be responsible for derailing the effort to win World War II.
How did you become aware of this, and what made it interesting to you to write about?
I came across this story while I was actually working on a different project, and I came across this amazing black and white photograph. It was taken by Ed Westcott. And as I said, he was the official photographer in Oak Ridge during World War II. And in this photograph, there are two rows of very young women sitting on stools in front of these gigantic
yes.
panels, just mm-hmm. tremendous floor-to-ceiling panels covered in knobs and dials and gauges. And it's this just gargantuan room. And I was, kind of struck by the photo and then the accompanying text. It was a DOE newsletter. The accompanying text said, these young women, many of them recent high school graduates from rural Tennessee, are helping enrich uranium for the world's first atomic bomb, but they were unaware of that at the time. And that photo and that information really, really hooked me, and that was the beginning of my investigation.
When we come back from the break, we're going to bring Chuck into the conversation. Chuck from Statesville, whose mother, he says, worked on the project at Oak Ridge. Denise Kiernan, our guest, The Girls of Atomic City, the book. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Magazine, now celebrating its 45th anniversary. Subscriptions to Charlotte City Magazine are available online at charlottemagazine.com. And Birdhouse on the Greenway, providing bird feeders, bird baths, and bird seed for creating bird and wildlife habitats. Located in the shops at Piper Glen, bringing people and nature together. Birdhouseonthegreenway.com. Coming up next at 10 o'clock in about 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show, it's the Friday News Roundup. President Barack Obama seeks support for military strikes in Syria. The White House steps up its public relations campaign for healthcare enrollment and the latest unemployment numbers. Those are some of the topics on the Diane Rehm Show when a panel of journalists will join guest host Susan Page for the analysis of the week's top national news stories at 10 here on 90.7 WFAE. Over 75 golfers will play in the Greater Hickory Kia Classic. This Champions Tour event stops at Rock Barn Golf and Spa in Conover, October 14th through the 20th. Ticket information is at GreaterHickoryKiaClassic.com. WFAE is pleased to be a community partner.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Girls of Atomic City, the untold story of the women who helped win World War II. That's the name of a New York Times best-selling book by our guest today, Denise Kiernan, who has been here several times in the past with other books about American history. This one is particularly fascinating and very unlike the other two books that you are on here about, which were very short, pithy little books. This is an in-depth study of a very interesting part of our history. And Chuck in Statesville is going to join us now. His mother, he says, worked on the project at Oak Ridge. Chuck, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me. Actually, it was my mother-in-law.
Okay.
But, yeah, she was, your guest was just talking about the photograph and the girls sitting on stools, setting the dials.
Mm-hmm.
My mother-in-law was one of those girls. I don't know if she was one in the photograph, but that's what she did. That was her job.
She was a Calutron cubicle operator.
Exactly. Yeah.
And what were they doing with the Calutron cubicle?
What they were doing is they were the cubicle operators. Those panels in the photo that Chuck's referring to were controlling the Calutrons themselves. Calutrons were units devised by Ernest Lawrence, a famous physicist who championed the electromagnetic separation process. So without getting into too much, you know, detail, they were separating isotopes of uranium. They were separating the more fissile isotope of uranium from the more kind of dormant, less active.
And all these women knew, Denise and Chuck, were the numbers that they were told to look at on these dials. Is that right?
Or where a particular needle went. I know, Chuck, did your mother-in-law ever talk about that?
Yeah, she has talked about it, not in a lot of detail. I am learning so much today from you, and I've got to get your book and get one for her. But actually, what she would say was just that she was just out of high school. She lived in Sweetwater, Tennessee, and still does. And she would go up on the bus and work her shift. And she was told to make sure that the needle would stay within a certain range.
That's right.
And if it began to move, then she would need to turn the dial to get it back within range. And again, she had no idea what she was working on, but she would go up with a group of her friends, work her shift and come back. She would, you know, take lunch up there, maybe some boiled eggs, that kind of thing, and she would sit on her stool for her shift and then come back on the bus.
Now, I have to ask, back in the 1940s, even though we knew about radiation and we knew a little bit about uranium, we didn't know much. And I know that when they were experimenting with this in Chicago, I think, they put a bunch of uranium on a squash court. Were these women at risk? Were these people at risk from radiation poisoning because they didn't know to be shielded from it?
One of the things you have to keep in mind when you hear about the town of Oak Ridge or any of the Manhattan Project towns, everybody's mind immediately goes to, you know, oh my gosh, they were around, you know, uranium.
Yeah.
This was a 58,000 acre site with four major plants, so there was a ton of mercury. There was asbestos, which everybody thought was great back then.
Yeah.
Fire
retardant.
Yeah, yeah. Asbestos was a fire retardant. I mean, so there was, you know, mercury, asbestos, fluorine, beryllium. I mean, you know, liquid nitrogen. There were so many. In many ways, you had the same challenges and health risks that any large industrial site would offer. The uranium itself, for example, folks like Chuck's mother-in-law, they were in a separate room from where the actual machines were, and the uranium was contained within those units. So it really depended on, you know, it depended on what your proximity was to the material and whether or not you were, you know, there were people dealing with them in dry boxes, you know, when they, the chemists who were dealing with them would, were dealing with it in dry boxes. But of course, they did the best they could back then based on what they knew.
Right.
They were still learning so much about the effects of radiation. And in many ways, that's a story that's still being written today, and there are still people, you know, doing research into the after effects of that situation on all the Manhattan Project sites.
Chuck, thank you for your call. Let me go to Sarah. You have a relative who was also there, right, Sarah?
Right. My grandmother was also from Sweetwater, Tennessee, like the last caller, and she worked on the bookkeeper. And she had a lapel pin that she showed me when I was little, and she used to tell stories of the lapel pins that I helped win the war. And that was really special to her, that she had been a part of something that big that she was really proud of. And when I was young, I used to hear these stories, and all I could think about was how she was a part of killing so many people. And that was really hard for me. I was very conflicted about that. She was so proud of it. And I was so excited to hear about this book. And I saw you on John Stewart, and I bought the book on Amazon before the show was even over to give my mom for Mother's Day. And I'm so excited to read about it, because now that she's gone, I can appreciate, and I'm older, I can appreciate her side of it and how proud she was. And I'm so proud of her now. She took those bookkeeping skills that she got on this project, and she went to work for a bank and became, you know, one of the first women to work to get as high as she did in the bank there. So I'm excited to be able to say how proud I am of her today, because I spent a lot of time really conflicted about
that. Wow, thank you, Sarah. I was going to bring this up later. Let's talk about that for a second, because they didn't know what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know what they were working on.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them didn't find out what they were working on until the day the bomb was dropped.
Until August 6, 1945. You're absolutely right.
How did they react, many of them, the ones that you talked to? How did they react
mm-hmm.
that day?
One of the things that I really tried to do in this book was to put everybody in the mindset of these women on that day.
Mm-hmm.
When you and I and
Sarah—that's how you start the book, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, exactly. And when you and I or Sarah, you know, here, when we talk about or think about anything having to do with the atomic bomb, we have this entire vast collective consciousness of information about what the bomb means, because we grew up in a world where it always existed. These women lived in a world, they really straddled two worlds. I mean, the dawn of the nuclear age changed many, many, many things. I mean, they grew up, they never heard the phrase nuclear winter. There was no such thing as a fallout shelter. There was no idea or concept of someone somewhere who could push one button and decimate entire populations. So they were not coming to August 6, 1945 with all that in their minds.
Right.
So what happens that day, people found out because there was only radio and newspapers. And if you were in a plant, you probably didn't have access to either. So the women who were housewives and were at home actually found out first. Someone would call someone at a plant, then people will start talking. And the first bits of information and in the paper were really, there's a super bomb, you know. It's like, oh, there's a super bomb, and it looks like the tide's turning. And then more information gradually starts to come out about the extent of the devastation. And a lot of that became clear months after that day.
Okay.
But it was a very conflicting feeling for, you know, a lot of the women I talk to, you get two sides. One is, around you, the entire country is celebrating the end of World War II. Husbands, you know, sons are coming, brothers are coming back for, and everybody is so happy the war is over. On the other hand, if you worked on the project, it was beginning to sink in. You were a part of something that, while it may have helped end the war, was also responsible for a lot of devastation. And it was a conflict.
But if you walk down any street in America, there were flags on windows that indicated that they had somebody fighting the war or
service
somebody
flags.
Lost to the war.
That's right.
everybody knew somebody who had died mm-hmm. in the conflict because it was raging all over the world. So something that hastens the end of the war.
That's right.
And brings the guys home.
Yeah.
Is going to be viewed differently then than today. Have the women that you talk to.
I'll tell one woman said, I mean, this to me, I'll just, one woman I spoke with said something that I thought was very simple and very, really kind of poignant. She said, I was so happy when we found out, she said, I was so happy that the war was over and my brother was going to come back. But I really like people, so I was kind of sad too.
Yeah.
And I don't know how else, I don't know how else better to put it.
And the, of the women that you talked to, did they have their feelings about what they has, I don't know how they asked the question. have their feelings about the bomb and what they did to help create the bomb changed from the time they first found out what they were involved in to today when they realized how that led to the Cold War and potential nuclear annihilation and these hundreds and hundreds and thousands of nuclear weapons that are scattered around the world today? Have they changed their feelings?
Well, what I think is interesting is though these individuals who worked here did not know what they were working on and certainly were not part of any sort of decision-making process, now, years later, in many ways, they are the ones telling the story of what happened. And, you know, some of these women working as docents in the museum, you know, Dot told a story about, you know, a woman coming up to her, you know, she was in her 60s or something and saying, well, how do you feel about killing all those people? And, you know, this is a woman who, you know, she had just gone to work to, you know, she had lost a brother in Pearl Harbor
yeah.
and she wanted to go work to help end the war.
Right.
And to lay all that at her feet, as opposed to the government's, is a little, you know, it's a very interesting situation.
Take 9/11 and multiply it by a great many numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your call, Sarah. Let me go to Annette in Concord. Annette, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I was one of the first people to move in Oak Ridge at age 3 with my parents who were from the area. And that you were talking about these houses, they were meant to last only 10 years, I believe, was
yep.
the maximum, or 5.
Mm-hmm.
And 70 years later, these houses are still there. The town is still vibrant. The place has changed greatly, but it's still home to me. We grew up there with the badges. You were talking about the radiation thing. The people who worked there, and I was one of them later, we had badges that had dosimeters on them, and they checked them with the Geiger counters as we left every day, and we turned them in, so you knew how much radiation you were or were not exposed to, and I'm sure that had been going on when my daddy was there and mother. It's an interesting place because it was planned out to the nth degree. So many houses for so many people with so many children were in this neighborhood, and so that neighborhood had an elementary school.
And isn't there a book in that? I mean, we have such a dysfunctional government today. In 1942, when President Roosevelt said we're doing this, they put this place up overnight, literally
it's
overnight.
It's amazing to think of how quickly all that went up and what we had. And, of course, as a child, I didn't understand any of the other stuff. I was just happy to be going to a school that had so many things that you wouldn't think of in that early 40s time, that a school would have kindergarten built in and so many things that we were afforded. It's just an amazing time.
Annette, thank you so much for sharing that. I appreciate it. Let me go to Jennifer in Mooresville. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I, too, was born and raised in Oak Ridge, and my parents met there. I wanted to tell your author I read the book. I absolutely love the book.
Thank you so much.
It's one of those I could not put down. I know some of the people in the book. and I want to tell you, too, you really captured the positive and the negative of the social scene at the time. My parents met while they were both young and fresh out of high school, one from Kingsport, Tennessee, one from Nashville, it was almost like a college campus sounds to me, the way they describe it, dances and parties and just so many ways to meet other young people once they decided they had to have that.
Well, you made you said a lot of these women, all of these women came as single women, and many of them got married as a result of their experience there. One of them married the guy who carried her suitcase up the stairs when she first arrived.
That's true. One of my women came as a married woman, Katie, who's the an African-American woman, came with her husband, and due to segregation was not actually allowed to live with him when she moved to Oak Ridge.
Why not?
It was a segregated reservation. So housing.
She was African American.
Yes.
He African American?
Yes.
So why couldn't they live together?
Because they decided that African American husbands and wives were going to live in separate housing areas.
Isn't that special?
Yeah. Yes, and so as you know, as Jennifer said, there were good parts and there were bad parts.
Jennifer, thank you for your call. You mentioned a guy named the Prophet John Hendricks several times. Just very quickly, he died in 1903, but he predicted this. How
it's a very, very popular tale in Oak Ridge. And he went out into the woods and, you know, laid on the ground. It was cold. By the time he woke up, his hair was frozen to the ground. And he, you know, went into town. And he had been known for his sort of, you know, storytelling and rambling and visions. And he went into town and talked about, you know, buildings and plants that would, you know, save the world, the greatest war the world had ever seen. And this would be built here and this would be built there. And the sites and locations that he mentioned, and this is, you know, this is many, many years, decades before the town was built, lined up with, you know, where the administrative headquarters was going to be, where the Y-12 plant was going to be. It's really very interesting. Interesting.
And
he's still buried there. He's in the middle of a subdivision now. You can go see his grave.
And is it still classified? Because you got too close to Y-12 and was pulled over by a government.
Oh, the first time I went and did it, I made a right of a block early. And yes, got a very friendly visit from some security officers.
So it's still classified. Amazing. The Girls of Atomic City. It's a New York Times bestseller, the untold story of the women who helped win World War II, by our guest today, Denise Kiernan. Come back, because you keep coming back with fascinating books. Keep coming
back. I'll come back.
Okay.